Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, A Significant Year for Religious Liberty, an update on the 2024-2025 Supreme Court term, featuring Professor Mark Rienzi and Professor William Saunders. In the interest of time, I will only briefly introduce our moderator. However, the following extensive bios for both of our speakers can be found on our website. William Saunders is the co-director of the Center for Religious Liberty at the Columbus School of Law and professor focusing on human rights, religious liberty, and bioethics at the Catholic University of America. Additionally, at CUA, he is a law fellow with the Institute for Human Ecology and director of the Center for Human Rights. A graduate of Harvard Law School, he is also chair emeritus of the Religious Liberties Practice Group here at the Federalist Society. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor Saunders, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. Welcome to everybody. It's great to be with you on another Federalist Society podcast. I want to introduce our featured speaker, who is my co-director, or I'm his co-director, at the Center for Religious Liberty at Catholic University. And like me, he's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He is president of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, and he is a professor at the School of Law, the Columbus School of Law at Catholic University. So today podcast is titled, you know, A Significant Term for Religious Liberty, ? So we want to discuss that and give our thoughts about how the term might end up, probably at the end of June, unless it goes over. And it did not look like a significant term for religious liberty until January, where the court took several cases and has had oral argument in several cases. One of these is the Washington State v. Catholic Charities, Wisconsin against Catholic Charities. One is the Mahmoud case in Maryland about school students opt out. And one is the charter school case in Oklahoma, the Isidore School. So I just want to say before I turn over to Mark that I was not able to hear the oral arguments for various reasons in these cases, but Mark was able to, and he'll give us our thoughts. I also just want to say quickly, I did benefit, though, from FedSoc programming having to do with these cases. The Religious Liberty Group at Federalist Society did a great job of having webinars or podcasts like this after each case, and they did some previews of these cases. So now that all three cases have been argued, we want to take stock. So with that, Mark, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Bill, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Yeah, as Bill said, the religion aspect of this term came together rather late. For a long time, the court had been having a pretty robust religious liberty docket from, say, 2011 until 2022 or so. Court always had one and sometimes had two or three religious liberty cases, but they hadn't taken any in a few years, from 22 until the beginning of this year. But then suddenly in January, as they were filling out the rest of this term, they, in kind of rapid succession, granted in these three cases to put a lot of religious liberty toward the back end of what they heard this term. And so what I want to do is just go through the three cases that they put on the docket, talk a little bit about what happened at oral argument, and a little bit about what we might be expecting come the end of the term in June when they'll decide these. So the first of the cases Bill mentioned is Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. And of the three of them, this is the one that might be the most shocking that it even had to get to the Supreme Court. This is a fight where Wisconsin has an exemption to one of its tax laws for entities that are operated primarily for religious purposes. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court somehow looked at Catholic Charities and said Catholic Charities doesn't qualify as operated for religious purposes. And the way the Wisconsin Supreme Court got to that bizarre outcome was the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, well, we kind of know what we think typical religious groups will act like. And we look at Catholic Charities and we say Catholic Charities gives charity to people who aren't Catholic. They help people who are in need, regardless of their own religious beliefs. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, we think a typical religious group would only give charity to its own members. So we don't think that counts as religious purposes. And by the way, atheists can give out help to the poor, too. So we don't think the charity here could count as for religious purposes. And the court also said, this is the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the court also said that we also think a real religious organization, something operated for religious purposes, would proselytize when giving out the help. In other words, they wouldn't just give the hungry person a free sandwich or the person who's homeless some free shelter. They would, you know, essentially require that you join the faith or that you practice the faith or you at least listen to some pitch about the faith as a condition of getting the help. Well, this is a big problem for Catholic Charities because Catholic Charities' religious beliefs run the other way. They think they really ought to help everybody regardless of their religious faith, and they shouldn't make sitting through a homily the price of getting the sandwich for the hungry guy on the street. And so Wisconsin said Catholic Charities doesn't count as religious. And I should say this is a Beckett Fund case. So just to get my disclaimers out of the way, both the Wisconsin case and Mahmoud versus Taylor are cases where my firm, the Beckett Fund, is counsel. So take that for what it's worth with my views of the cases. So we petitioned for cert in Catholic Charities of Wisconsin, and the court granted cert. And the argument for that one happened at the very end of March, March 31st. And I would say from that oral argument, it seems pretty clear there's a strong majority on the court who thinks there's something wrong with Wisconsin saying this is what typical religious groups do and will only give the religious exemption to groups we think are typical. One of what I thought was the most striking moments of the argument was when Justice Alito asked Wisconsin's lawyer, so you know, basically, like, tell me what does Catholic Charities have to do differently to qualify as operated for religious purposes under your rule? And I just want to make sure I read the quote directly. Wisconsin's lawyer said, I think if when they deliver, say, the soup to the recipient, they say, recipient, we're both going to say the Lord's Prayer. That could be one thing. So in other words, Wisconsin's basically saying you don't get to count as religious unless you insist on praying with a person before giving them their soup. Well, as you can imagine, that struck many of the justices as a bit of an odd thing for a governmental entity to insist on. Like, we usually don't think of the government insisting on prayer. But that seemed odd. And Justice Kagan immediately followed up and said, but I thought it was pretty fundamental that we don't treat some religions better than others. And obviously, some religions preach and do things precisely the way Wisconsin's saying, and others don't. And Justice Kagan said it seemed pretty problematic to have the government treating some religions better than others based on their religious doctrines about whether they serve people of different faiths and whether they proselytize as they do it. There was a lot of discussion at the court about how exactly to decide the case, because a rule like Wisconsin's, perhaps unsurprisingly, violates lots of different elements of religious liberty doctrine. One of the aspects that Justice Kagan focused on was, you know, what I call sort of discrimination among polities. Right. Justice Kagan pointed out that it's, I should go back one step. Wisconsin said that they would exempt Catholic Charities if the work was done simply under the diocese itself, as opposed to as a separate corporation. Wisconsin said if it was under the diocese itself, that we'd exempt. but we don't want to treat you as religious if you are a separate corporation, you know, sort of part of the diocese, but a separate corporation. And what Justice Kagan said is, doesn't that really put a lot of pressure on religions to organize their polities in very particular ways? And why should the government be exerting that pressure? And that's a point that Justice Gorsuch also came back to, is this idea of the pressure that the government's putting on a religious group to organize its affairs in a certain way. I don't think Wisconsin ever had a very strong answer to that. And I would point out that that's one where, if the court were to incorporate that idea into its ruling, the court could actually use the case to resolve a lot of other religious liberty disputes that are out there. So if you recall back to things like the contraceptive mandate litigation with the Little Sisters of the Poor from years ago, there, the federal government said, well, if the Little Sisters would just give the keys to the nursing home to the bishop and let the bishop run it, then that would be a religious entity. We'd exempt that one. But because the sisters operate and run the entity on their own, then we think we can subject them to the mandate. I'll just say to the group that there's actually lots of things like that that happen in lots of different state situations where they're discriminating among religious objectors based on how they organize. And so if the court were to go with the line Justice Kagan were raising, I think that might actually help them resolve some others. To be clear, there are lots of other angles explored at argument. Justice Gorsuch also talked about how there's just discrimination among different religious groups going on here, and isn't that obviously impermissible? Which it is. And so I think the court will have some choosing to do about how it resolves it. I should say the Solicitor General's office also filed a brief and made some strong arguments on the constitutional grounds. They did also suggest that maybe the court could just resolve the case on statutory grounds and just say the Wisconsin Supreme Court is wrong about how it's interpreting Wisconsin's statute, because that statute is based on a federal statute. And I'll just say it didn't sound like the justices had much interest in resolving it by purporting to interpret the Wisconsin statute. So I think we're likely to get a constitutional ruling, maybe on the autonomy ground that Justice Kagan was talking about, maybe on the religious discrimination ground. One other potential ground that was raised in an amicus brief by Christian Legal Society is that in Christian Legal Society, there was some discussion about whether governance decisions are really outside the rule of Smith, right? Sort of who leads and how you run your organization, whether it's outside the rule of Smith and whether it's governed by things like Hosanna Tabor and other church autonomy principles. And, you know, that's another creative suggestion there that would give the court a way to use a case like this to clean up its doctrine and improve the doctrine a little bit by making clear that things like who a group chooses as its leader, for example, which was the issue in CLS versus Martinez years ago, just isn't covered by Smith and isn't the kind of thing the government gets to control. So, the court will have lots of options for what it does in a case like this.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say one theme. I don't know if any other listeners have this same approach, but my general view is these three cases, so I'm saying it now, it's a theme. And I think they're straightforward. And so I'm interested to hear what Mark says and, of course, what any of the listeners want to ask about, because I think I wouldn't say they're easy cases, but they're straightforward. And this one, the idea that the court is going to tell a Catholic organization that what its own religion defines as part of its religion, which is charity, is not, according to the court, religion is outrageous. And also that reference you made to Gorsuch, I mean, there are religious, Christian religious organizations that do that. They serve you, but you do have, you say the Lord's Prayer, you go to a prayer meeting or something. So some do and some don't. But for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to say the way Catholics do it is not religion seems to me quite, quite, outrageous.
Yeah, and I don't think any of the justices, when they were making that point, were denigrating the idea of doing it that way, right? I think right. they were just saying some religions do it one way, some religions do it another way, and right. what's odd is to think of a secular government putting a thumb on the scale and saying, well, we'll only treat you as religious if you do it this way. I mean, it's almost like saying, you know, we think normal religion preaches on Sunday, not on Saturday. And so if you're a typical Sunday religion, we think you're a religion, but not a Saturday. Like that's a bit of an odd thing to think the government should have a view on. And I'll say one more thing that came up with the argument that I think might be of interest to the listeners or the viewers. There was some discussion about whether an exemption for Catholic charities here basically means, well, everything that's religious gets out of all laws, right? I think in some ways the state's argument kind of, you know, traded on that notion that's what's being asked for here. But Catholic Charities was pretty clear in the argument to say they're not saying that they get out of every law, right? There were some questions about what would happen if there were a religious vegan restaurant. And I think the short of it is, no one's saying that the religious entity gets out of all laws, but they are saying that when the government establishes a religious exemption, the government can't say that, oh, well, we think preaching on Saturday is normal religion, but anything else doesn't count. Or we think proselytizing while you serve the food is normal religion and everything else doesn't count. I think that's really the problem Wisconsin's run into here.
Okay, well, let's touch base on the second case then, the Mahmoud.
Yeah, yes. So the second one is Mahmoud versus Taylor. That was argued in mid to late April. And this is the one over Montgomery County, nearby, not too far from Washington, D.C. And there were some questions from justices who lived in Montgomery County about it. But it's sort of right outside D.C. in Maryland. And the county a couple of years ago instituted what they called the Pride Curriculum. And the Pride Curriculum included a bunch of storybooks to be read to children as young as pre-K. So this is a set of storybooks for pre-K. I think it ran all the way up until fifth grade. And when the program started and the textbook, the books, the storybooks introduced same-sex relationships, they introduced same-sex playground romances, they introduced pride parades, they had little things in the back of the book where you find things to go search for at the pride parade, like leather or a particular famous sex worker and things like that. And unsurprisingly, some parents said, you know, gosh, I'd rather you don't teach that stuff to my 3 and 4 year olds. And for the first year, the county said, that's fine. We'll allow you to opt your child out of those storybooks. That's the way our rules in Maryland go anyways. If you've got a religious objection to something, you can just, you know, have your child sent to the library so he or she doesn't sit through the storybooks. And I should say the storybooks also came with teacher's guides that said they were designed to, quote, disrupt the children's either or thinking about sex and gender. In other words, disrupt the idea that children might have that there's boys and there's girls and they're different. And it also encouraged teachers to tell students that if they have contrary beliefs about these things, that that's hurtful and they shouldn't say it. So unsurprisingly, some significant number of parents in Montgomery County said, I'd like to opt my children out. But then in 2023, after promising those opt-outs and honoring them for the first year, Montgomery County said, no more opt-outs. You can't opt out of these storybooks. Ironically, you could still opt your child out of sex ed. So your high schooler can still get out of learning all sorts of stuff in sex ed, but your 3 and 4 year olds can't get out of the sex indoctrination lessons in preschool story time. Not surprising that led to a lawsuit, that led to a lot of parents complaining and saying that it violates their rights to not let them opt their children out of this instruction on you know, what is for many people a religiously sensitive topic. The lower courts, the district court in Maryland and a split panel on the Fourth Circuit said that the parents weren't burdened and didn't have a claim, right? They just said there is no burden on you if in the public schools you drop your child off and we teach them something you don't want us to teach them, and we don't notify you or give you any opt-out rights. They just said there is no burden. And so you have no claim. And I should say the claims were brought, you know, there are really two principal types of claims that were issued at the Supreme Court. One is a claim under Wisconsin v. Yoder, right? That's the famous case about the Amish opting their children out of the last couple of years of high school from 50 years ago in Wisconsin. And the other was sort of a typical Smith, this law is not neutral and generally applicable type of challenge. So the Supreme Court granted cert, and that argument was again in mid-April. And I would say that argument also seemed to go quite well for the religious party. There was a lot of discussion with the court about what are the meets and bounds of a rule. And I think it's clear that that's something they're going to be working through. But it certainly sounded like a significant number of the justices understood that there was a real burden on parents here. The one justice who seemed to push hard against the burden idea was Justice Jackson, who basically said, look, like, you don't have to put your children in public school. You can homeschool your children. You can pay for private school. So maybe there's not a burden at all. I don't think there's more than one or maybe two votes for that line of reasoning. That didn't sound it at the argument, basically on the idea that, sure, it's true that some people can afford to send their kids to private school, or some people can afford to have one parent stay home and homeschool. But that's just not true for most people. And there's at least many people in the public school system who really have no reasonable alternative to satisfy their obligation to educate their children, but to use the government's school. So a lot of the discussion was about whether there's a burden and what does that mean for the school system. And so like under Wisconsin v. Yoder, there were questions, well, is this like Wisconsin v. Yoder? And in what ways is it like Yoder? In some ways, Yoder was a bigger ask, right? Because in Yoder, the request was, I want to take my child out of that system entirely because of my religious beliefs. Here, the parents are only asking to pull their child out of a handful of select lessons and send them to the library. There were some questions about, well, what would it mean if we say there is a burden on a parent who has a religious objection to putting their child in this classroom? What does that mean for parents who object to, you know, evolution, or if they object to some lesson about vaccines or race relations or something else? How would we run a system like that? And one of the things that came out at the argument is that Montgomery County here is really kind of an outlier in that most public schools across the country actually have very robust opt-outs for anything to do with sex, right? So teaching sex in schools is a relatively modern invention. In most school districts, it comes with an express either you must opt in or you get to opt out type of policy. And in many school districts, including in Maryland, actually, if Montgomery County were following Maryland law, there are actually rather broad opt-outs for people who've got religious objections to other things. In Hawaii, there's an opt-out from any lesson that the parent thinks is controversial for any reason, right? In Montgomery County, if, as I said before, they allowed you to opt out of this lesson until, you know, a year into it, when they decided that they would not brook any departures and not allow any more opt-outs. But opt-outs actually exist in many school districts for a long time, and there don't seem to have been any major problems with a lot of people opting out of evolution. I think in some ways, the argument that we can't handle opt-outs kind of trades on an idea of the school system that isn't all that accurate about how schools operate these days. The assumption that, well, we can't have it lessons that students opt out from because otherwise the schools can't handle it. Sounds as if we think schools are these one size fits all places where everyone gets the same course of study and no one leaves the room. In reality, in Montgomery County, something like one out of every eight students has an individualized education plan under federal IDEA. And they're coming in and out of classrooms all the time, and they get differential treatment, whether it's because the book is at the wrong Lexile level or some other reason. Montgomery County itself said it would exempt and I should say the case is Mahmoud versus Taylor. The lead plaintiffs here are Muslim. Montgomery County actually said in the briefs that they would exempt Muslim parents from having their children read a book that had an image of the Prophet Muhammad in it, because that's offensive. And the county ran into a lot of difficulty with the justices at argument over those kinds of lines that they want to draw and why that's not discriminatory, and why the fact that they're able to allow these other opt-outs and sort of ways of individualizing the curriculum, whether that doesn't show that, well, of course you could allow these folks to opt out here too. Go ahead, Bill.
No, you go ahead, Mark.
I say one question that got a little bit of attention at the end is whether the court will get to strict scrutiny, right? So in other words, if it's sounds pretty clear that the court thinks there is a real burden on these parents who are forced to, you know, let their kids be subjected to this teaching and don't get to opt them out. There's some discussion about, well, will we get to strict scrutiny? Should we get to strict scrutiny? Because the courts below just said no burden, and therefore they didn't analyze strict scrutiny. I'll say the court in lots of other recent cases that are kind of parallel has just gotten to strict scrutiny. That was the case in Fulton, for example. The lower courts had just said you don't even get to strict scrutiny, but the court eventually applied it. And this is one where I think the strict scrutiny argument is pretty straightforward and based on sort of the undisputed facts and law of what Montgomery County already allows. There's no dispute that they already allow all the high school kids to be opted out of lessons about this stuff if it's in sex ed. There's no dispute that they allow an eighth of their students to be pulled out regularly for IDEA, individualized education plans. There's no dispute that they'd let you opt out for a picture of Prophet Muhammad. So I think the court will probably go ahead and just reach strict scrutiny. The county's argument is, well, we haven't put in any evidence yet about exactly how difficult it would be in each individual school to opt students out and send them to the library and so forth. I'm not sure the court's going to go for that. I mean, ultimately, that's kind of a choice the county made along the way. Strict scrutiny was argued and briefed by both sides at each stage of the proceedings on the way up. I suspect the county didn't put in those facts precisely because they were hunting for and rooting for a legal argument that doesn't turn on those facts. But having made those decisions, I'm not sure they're going to be able to rely on them to get out of having the court address strict scrutiny here. Let me pause there, Bill, because I cut you off. Sorry.
No, it's fine. I just wanted to say two things. One is there's been some talk about this case where some people have said the court shouldn't just recognize a religious freedom or liberty opt out because there are parents who aren't religious who have moral objections. But I would think that given what you just said about opt outs generally and how wide they're available, even parents with a quote moral but not religious objection are not likely to be hurt by a pro-religious freedom decision in this case.
No, actually, I think the way it often works is the opposite. Like, to be clear, the plaintiffs in this case are religious, but it wouldn't surprise me, and I'd be sympathetic if there are parents who aren't religious but who still say, you don't need to, you know, tell my 3-year-old that she should go think about whether she's a boy or a girl or both or neither. What often happens is when governments recognize a religious exemption, they will also recognize a parallel moral objection. I certainly think that's the right thing to do. That's the way we do it in the military. That's the way we do it with abortion. It's the way we do it with a lot of very sensitive things. So often ordinary politics leads governments to do what I think is the right thing and also respect those parents. So I suspect that's the path it would take.
Yeah, I mean, in some of the, you know, Supreme Court cases talk about religious or moral objections. So let me pause for 1 second just to say organizationally, I don't know if I said this, but if you have questions or our discussion is raising questions in your mind, drop them into the Q&A function and we'll get to them later. So, Mark, let's move to the third case, which is the St. Isidore Charter School case.
Yeah, this is the Oklahoma Charter School case. This is one where Oklahoma has a charter school program and previously had a law that said religious groups couldn't apply. But the Oklahoma Statewide Charter Board wanted to allow religious groups to apply for charters on equal terms that other private groups are allowed to apply for charters. But the Oklahoma Supreme Court said they couldn't do it. The Oklahoma Supreme Court said that a charter school is a state actor, and that because they're a state actor, cases like the Carson v. Macon Trinity Lutheran Espinoza trilogy that the courts decided over, say, the past decade, that those cases, and those cases, I should say, stand for the proposition that the government can't have a program that says everybody can apply except the religious people, right? So that was the case in Trinity Lutheran with the Scraps for Playgrounds program. That was the case in Espinoza for the tuition tax credit. That was the case in Carson for the essentially school vouchers or the town tuition credits. And all of them, the government said, we have an open program that everybody can participate in, and then said, except the religious people. And the Supreme Court, in case after case after case, opinion after opinion, said, no, you can't do that. And so the Oklahoma case is, I think, the next step in that trilogy, or the question of the applicability of that trilogy. And so the Oklahoma Charter Board, which wanted to approve the religious school and the religious school, both petitioned to the Supreme Court. The court granted the petition. This was argued to an 8-justice court. Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused. She didn't and doesn't have to give any reasons for the recusal, so we don't know precisely why she recused, but she's recused. So this is argued to 8 justices. And the school and the charter board, which wanted to approve the school, made the argument that, look, this is basically a straightforward application of the Carson trilogy, because under the rule that the Oklahoma Supreme Court laid down, what we're saying is that any private group that wants to can come forward and apply for a charter. And if you get it, we will authorize and fund your school. But not religious schools. And the argument from the petitioners was, well, like, the government's not allowed to have a program that says, but not religious applicants. That's the problem from Carson. And so it might be a different application of that problem, but it's the same problem. In some ways, I think this case is very much about the framing. And I think the words public school or public charter school are doing an awful lot of work for the respondents in the case, right? The respondents are saying, well, it's a public school. How could you have a public school that is religious? How could you have a public school with a crucifix on the wall? And ultimately, I think where it sounded like the court was going was that the court was, accepting that Carson framing, that this is just excluding religions. Actually, there's an awful lot of discussion about a case of ours from a few terms ago, Fulton versus City of Philadelphia over Catholic foster care. Because with Catholic foster care in Philadelphia, it was another situation where, like, no one can do foster care without cooperating with the government. No one can do it without a government contract. And Catholic Charities in that case had a government contract. But it was also just as clear, and the court decided that case 9-0. It was also just as clear in that case that Catholic Charities didn't become a state actor just by getting the license from the government and the funding from the government to help with foster care. And at the argument in the charter school case, Chief Justice Roberts in particular was making this point and saying, look, like, it sounds kind of the same as what was going on in cases like Fulton, where sure, it's a government program and sure, there's government dollars. But we've never before said that simply by participating in the government program and taking the government dollars, you yourself become a state actor that lets the government exclude you for your religion. And so, yeah, I think the argument from Oklahoma's side, the respondent, the state of Oklahoma that was defending the state Supreme Court, was basically, look, if you allow this, then you are essentially allowing full-fledged government religious schools. And I think the answer to that, and where the justices sounded like they were leaning, is that that's not quite what this is. No one really thinks of St. Isidore Charter School as the government's charter school. It's clear it's the Archdiocese of Oklahoma's charter school. And that really this is just about funding and, you know, something akin to licensure, right? Being allowed to have the charter. And, you know, Justices Gorsuch and I think Kavanaugh made clear in some of their questioning that they seem to think governments could have a situation where all the schools or all the charter schools really were government run schools. In other words, where the government sits on the board, where the government picks the teachers, where the government sets the curriculum. You could have that And that would be quite a different case from this one. But the way charters work, at least in Oklahoma, is not that way at all. Like the government isn't the one that selects the teachers. The government, you know, looks at the curriculum the way accreditors look at curriculums of most religious schools. But the government isn't really running it. And no one really thinks the government's running it. And so it's not really the government's. And so I think on that one, it seems unlikely to me that the court is going to declare that St. Isidore's school, you know, founded by the Archdiocese of Oklahoma, has suddenly become a state actor. I think it seems far more likely that they're going to say this is either under the Carson Trilogy or under something like Fulton. This is just a place where the government is discriminating against religious institutions, and it's not authorized to do that. Let me stop there. Bill, happy to have any discussion with you, or then also happy to take any questions from the group.
Well, I just say that, again, we wanted to kind of consider these three cases individually, but also collectively, because whether this will be a big term for the court on religious liberty with these three cases pending, do you anticipate, Mark, any? I mean, to me, again, and I was not a lawyer in the case like you were, to me, these three seem to follow from previous case law and a pro-religious, I expect them to go in a pro-religious freedom direction. But do you expect any doctrinal changes here, one way or the other?
Yeah, that really is the big question, is kind of how did they write these opinions? I'll take them one at a time. In Catholic Charities versus Wisconsin, I think the question is how much will they say about church autonomy? Church autonomy is a principle that in Hosanna Tabor and then Our Lady of Guadalupe, we've seen the court recently build out a little bit, and they've built it out sort of as a separate ground for decision, separate from just Employment Division versus Smith, kind of standard free exercise law. They've built this out as separate. And so in Catholic Charities of Wisconsin, to me, the interesting thing to think about is, what's the court going to say about church autonomy? What's the court going to say about discrimination among church polities? I think that's a place where if they address the issues in the right way, they can clean up some of the doctrine that's been kind of messy, and they can correct some of the missteps that have gone on in the lower courts and other governments. In Mahmood versus Taylor, I think
Just one second, because sorry to interrupt you, Mark.
Yeah.
But we got a couple of questions that I think we're getting at that what you were just saying. So I just wanted to one ask this case you're discussing, it's a ridiculous result, but it's an issue of statutory interpretation. Why was it cert worthy? Do you think the court was granting cert to do something like you were just describing?
Yeah, I mean,
we're just guessing, right?
Yeah, we're just guessing, right? So that's the first, is we're just guessing. But I think so. So, I mean, why was it cert worthy, right? You had the highest court of a state say that the free exercise clause has nothing to say about whether a state picks and chooses who gets religious exemptions this way. I think that's clearly and obviously wrong, but I think it's a big deal. And on its own, that's cert worthy, right? A state Supreme Court that gets the free exercise clause that wrong is cert worthy. And it does map with and match, this was in the cert petition, which is a ways back, but it matches with some similar errors that we've seen in other places. So I suspect the reason it appealed to the court is that they looked at it and said, okay, well, this is the kind of mistake that is important for us to set right so that we get better, clearer, more consistent rulings from the lower courts. It really doesn't make any sense for religious groups, whether it's in Wisconsin under this law or in some other state with some other law, it doesn't make sense for religious groups to be feeling this kind of pressure from the government on how they organize themselves or which religious practices they engage in. That's not the government's role. So I suspect the court is looking to say something like that. It's just a question of how they say it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What were you saying about Mahmood? Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah. In Mahmood, I think the interesting doctrinal question is just what to do with Wisconsin versus Yoder. Wisconsin versus Yoder is I think a great decision by the court that is pretty strong and clear in favor of religious liberty. the lower courts haven't always applied Wisconsin versus Yoder. They've kind of read into Yoder a, like, this is a special exception for the Amish type of treatment in Yoder. That I don't think there's anything in the court's decision in Yoder that justifies that, but they've done that. And so to me, like, this is the first time in 50 years the court has taken a case over parental opt-out rights in public schools. And so I'm certainly looking to see, will they actually, you know, ground the decision in Yoder and make clear that when the government interferes with that type of parental religious right and religious ability to supervise the upbringing of your children, when the government interferes with that, that triggers strict scrutiny. You'll recall in Smith, Justice Scalia kind of put Yoder to one side and said that's its own category. Well, the lower courts haven't done much with that category, but this is an opportunity for the Supreme Court to be clear that that's real and that Wisconsin versus Yoder is real and it's still good law. And that particularly parents seeking a much smaller exception, a much smaller ask of, let me just send my child to the library rather than pull them out of school entirely, that Yoder ought to protect that. They certainly could also decide the case on, you know, sort of more standard neutrality and general applicability grounds. One of the virtues of the Wisconsin versus Yoder approach, though, is that that allows them to, you know, kind of speak specifically to the school context rather than break any new broader ground. So that may be appealing. But again, we don't know. We'll wait and see. And then in the charter school cases, to me, the doctrinal questions are, does this and how does this fit within the Carson trilogy? I think it clearly does. Do cases like Fulton and other cases about participation in government funding programs, do those on their own weight say that the free exercise clause stops the government from doing that? So in all these cases, I think there are multiple doctrinal paths the court can go down. We're not really going to know until June what they do. But I suspect the court, as it always does, is taking these cases fully aware of what's going on in the lower courts and looking at each step to incrementally improve its doctrine and straighten some things out.
One of the questions we have on the charter school says, are the Blaine amendments, did they arise in this and do they arise in this? And are those, are the Blaine amendments still, are they affected by these cases?
Yeah, yes, they arise in this. They should be affected because I think the Carson trilogy killed them. In other words, I think a state law that says anybody but the religious can do X is kind of facially in violation of the Carson principle. Yes. But the Oklahoma Supreme Court was, you know, at least relying on echoes of its Blaine when it issued this ruling and said we can keep the religious groups out for these kind of anti-establishment reasons. So I think those Blaines really should be dead post Carson. But they still have a little bit of life left. And what, you know, and we've seen this in other places we're litigating post Carson, where school districts say, well, if I can't keep out just the religious people because they're religious, maybe I can say, okay, but if you're in the program, you can't have religious hiring. Or if you're in the program, you can't consider X or Y or Z in your selection of students or something like that. Basically, where the schools say, okay, well, we're gonna find a different way to keep the religious groups out. We're gonna impose some poison pills. In Maine, what they said was, well, if you allow any religious expression within your school, you have to allow it all equally, right? So any religious school that teaches one faith or talks about one faith has to allow everything equally, which of course is not the way most religious schools operate. So after Carson, we've seen a lot of governments trying to get around Carson and kind of find other ways to weasel their Blaine approach back in. I think the court's got an eye on those. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the court says something here that makes it clear that you can't really get away with that.
So it might be another thing that's been buried. We didn't know when, but it'd been killed. They tell us it's been killed, right? Like,
I think fair observers should know that the Blaines are all dead after Carson, but I'm not sure all the lower courts and all the governments got the message.
Well, one of these questions we have says it appears to be tension between in the First Amendment between free exercise establishment principles in the past. Establishment clause would trump free exercise. What's changed and why, other than the composition of the court?
Yeah, so I don't think it's actually just driven by the composition of the court at all. I think it's driven by what's actually an establishment, right? So like, you know, part of the question is like, is, you go back to Fulton, right? Like if the government spends money and licenses you to do foster care and you do it because you're trying to help the government care for these kids, have you magically become the government such that the cross on your wall is an establishment? You know, nine justices in Fulton saw it as really easy to say that's a free exercise case and not to take any of the bait on the establishment clause. That's not just the conservatives, that was all of them. And I think that principle that when people do things with the government, they don't become the government is actually a longstanding one. If you think about money that we use to care for poor folks, right? Medicaid, Medicare, private religious hospitals do that stuff all the time, right? And they provide tens or probably hundreds of millions of dollars in care with government funds for poor people. If the establishment clause thinking in the charter school case were right, you'd say, okay, well now all those entities magically become the state. And then we can say, because they have a cross on the wall or a chapel in the building, then maybe they're establishing religion. I just don't think that's terribly plausible under, it's not plausible under law in 2025, but I don't think that's terribly plausible under law in 1975 either.
Yeah. We've got a couple of questions, Mark, that go back to this question of parental rights. It's how far can parental rights as such, regardless of religion, to choose education, per the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is protected there, or be invoked. So how far can you use parental rights in these cases, regardless of religion? Now, I know that you know, in the cases you're involved in, religion is what you're talking about, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think there's a case to be made for strong parental rights to control the education of your children, religion or otherwise. That's not the claims being brought in these cases, because these are religious parents. But again, like I do think there's an argument to be made for that. When Justice Scalia was talking about Wisconsin versus Yoder and an earlier case called Pierce v. Society of Sisters, you know, he talked about sort of an independent 14th Amendment interest in raising your children. Well, 14th Amendment, you know, unlike the free exercise of religion clause, a 14th Amendment interest doesn't have to be tied to religion. So I think there's room to make arguments about parental rights under the 14th Amendment. There's room to make those under many state constitutions as well. And again, personally, I'm quite sympathetic to the idea that parents of any or no religion at all have important rights to oversee the education of their children, and that it's wrong for the government to say, basically, when you drop your kid off at the school door, I can indoctrinate with whatever I please. And you basically have no rights about it. That seems odd. Seems like the kind of thing we really resolved way back when we flipped from Gobitis to Barnett 80 years ago. And that ought to be true for everybody.
You know, one thing I wanted to just go back on, it's a couple of comments have raised it, and you and I talked about it a little bit, is again, I wasn't in oral argument, but my understanding is in the oral argument on the Wisconsin v. Catholic Charities case, excuse me, Justice Barrett wondered whether we needed a definition of religion.
Yeah.
That seems to be floating around here in all three of these cases. Do we?
Yeah, well, put it this way. I think we often need to say what's religious and what's not, but the court has gone a pretty long way, a few hundred years, without having to actually sort of define all the meets and bounds of what is religion. So she did ask that question, and there was a back and forth about it. I put all three of these categories in ones where I don't know that you need to write a new, clear, all, you know, sort of one rule to resolve them all definition of religion to answer any of these cases, right? Like, I don't think there's much doubt that the Archdiocese of Oklahoma is religious, or that the religious parents in Mahmood are religious, or that Catholic Charities of Wisconsin is religious. You know, I think there are edge cases. They show up far more in law review articles by nerdy law professors. I can say that because I am one. But they show far more in the sort of interesting musings of law professors than they do in the actual federal reports. And I think that's because most of the time, sincerity can do the work, and you can figure out like who's got a sincere and religious belief and who doesn't. Right. So you know, where are people likely to fake a religious belief? Well, they fake them to get out of going to war, right? So people might fake them in the conscientious objection context. They fake them to get to use drugs. They might fake them to try to get special treatment in prison. And courts deal with those cases. It's not like they don't deal with those cases. And I think sometimes they're able to look at something and say, yeah, like that's not real. Like, I don't think you've got a sincere religious belief there. Justice Gorsuch had a case over something called the Church of the Cognizance, which essentially was, you know, a guy who wanted to sell and smoke a lot of marijuana. And he, you know, the 10th Circuit decided that and said, look, I don't actually think these are real religious beliefs. I think you're making this up. And so courts tend to deal with it on that ground rather than saying, I know everything that could be religious within this diverse religious place. So I guess long way of saying someday I can imagine a case where they need to define exactly what counts as religion. These three seem like most of what we've had in the rest of our history, which is it's enough to decide that these are religious people and religious claims without having to decide all the edge cases about what might be borderline religion and not.
So Mark, to the listeners, we're coming near the end of this webinar. So I want to ask you, Mark, for final thoughts, but I'll put it in the context of the question, is this going to be a significant year for religious liberty at the court? Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I'd wrap up kind of where you started, Bill, which is at the beginning of this term, no one had any reason to think so. But with the flurry of cases they put on the docket in January about, you know, the scope of religious entities and religious nonprofits and what exemptions they're allowed on parental rights in public schools and on the participation of religious schools and charter programs, I think the court has set itself up for what you know very well could be a big term for religious liberty. We're going to have to wait and see exactly how they write those opinions and how the majorities come together. But I think they've taken some pretty meaty, serious and important issues. I don't think they're particularly close questions, but I do think they're important ones that the lower courts were getting wrong. And so I'm certainly heartened by what the court's taken, heartened by what happened at argument, and I expect to see good things from the court in June.
I mean, my thought is that the lower courts, a lot of them are still approaching these things with kind of a default worry about establishment, which is, of course, part of the First Amendment. But I think the First Amendment properly understood is that religion is a good. It's needed for America. It's protected in the Constitution. It builds moral citizens and virtuous citizens, which you have to have in a republic. And so this idea that we have to scourge the earth to keep any kind of religious things out of the public square is not only wrong, but far wrong. What we should be doing is finding ways appropriately, and that's not a weasel word, it's got to be decided appropriately to accommodate religion, because a religion is a good protected in the First Amendment. So I hope these cases will help to build that sense. Religion is not something to be feared or something. It's vital to a flourishing democracy.
That was certainly George Washington's view at the founding when he said that we've got a good constitution for a virtuous and religious citizenry. And Alexis de Tocqueville's view, you know, a few years after that, when he was writing about the early American Republic.
Yep. Marco, do you want to close us out?
Well, thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I would also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For more information on upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.